Just after the senior class trip to Washington, D.C., I got a job at Warrumbo Mills in Weaving, in Lisbon Falls. I didn't want it. The work was hard and boring, the mill itself a dingy fuckhole overhanging the polluted Androscoggin River like a workhouse in a Charles Dickens novel. But I needed the paycheck. My mother was making lousy wages as a housekeeper at a facility for the mentally ill in New Gloucester, but she was determined I was going to college like my brother David, University of Maine, class of 66, cum laude. In her mind, the education had become almost secondary. Durham and Lisbon Falls and the University of Maine at Orono were part of a small world where folks neighbored and still minded each other's business on the 4- and 6-party lines which then served the Sticksville townships. In the big world, boys who didn't go to college were being sent overseas to fight in Mr. Johnson's undeclared war, and many of them were coming home in boxes. My mother liked Lyndon's war on poverty. "That's the war I'm in," she sometimes said. But not what he was up to in Southeast Asia. Once I told her that enlisting and going over there might be good for me. Surely there would be a book in it, I said. "Don't be an idiot, Stephen," she said. "With your eyes, you'd be the first one to get shot. You can't write if you're dead." She meant it. Her head was set, and so was her heart. Consequently, I applied for scholarships, I applied for loans, and I went to work in the mill. I certainly wouldn't get far on the $5 and $6 a week I could make writing about bowling tournaments and soapbox derby races for the Enterprise. During my final weeks at Lisbon High, my schedule looked like this. Up at 7, off to school at 7:30, last bell at 2 o'clock, punch in on the third floor of Warrumbo at 2:58, bag loose fabric for 8 hours, punch out at 11:02, get home around 11:45, eat a bowl of cereal, fall into bed, get up the next morning, do it all again. On a few occasions, I worked double shifts, slept in my 60 Ford Galaxy, Dave's old car, for an hour or so before school, then slept through periods 5 and 6 in the nurse's cubicle after lunch. Once summer vacation came, things got easier. I was moved down to the dye house in the basement, for one thing, where it was 30 degrees cooler. My job was dyeing swatches of Melton cloth purple or navy blue. I imagine there are still folks in New England with jackets in their closets dyed by yours truly. It wasn't the best summer I ever spent, but I managed to avoid being sucked into the machinery or stitching my fingers together with one of the heavy-duty sewing machines we used to belt the undyed cloth. During 4th of July week, the mill closed. Employees with 5 years or more at Warrumbo got the week off with pay. Those with fewer than 5 years were offered work on a crew that was going to clean the mill from top to bottom, including the basement, which hadn't been touched in 40 or 50 years. I probably would have agreed to work on this crew. It was time and a half. But all the positions were filled long before the foreman got down to the high school kids, who'd be gone in September. When I got back to work the following week, one of the dye house guys told me I should have been there. It was wild. "The rats down in that basement were as big as cats," he said. "Some of them, goddamn if they weren't as big as dogs." "Rats as big as dogs. Yow." One day late in my final semester at college, finals over and at loose ends, I recalled the dye house guy's story about the rats under the mill. "Big as cats, goddamn, some as big as dogs," and started writing a story called Graveyard Shift. I was only passing the time on a late spring afternoon, but 2 months later, Cavalier magazine bought the story for $200. I had sold 2 other stories previous to this, but they had brought in a total of just $65. This was 3 times that, and at a single stroke. It took my breath away. It did. I was rich. During the summer of 1969, I got a work-study job in the University of Maine library. That was a season both fair and foul. In Vietnam, Nixon was executing his plan to end the war, which seemed to consist of bombing most of Southeast Asia into kibbles and bits. "Meet the new boss," the WHO sang, same as the old boss. Eugene McCarthy was concentrating on his poetry, and happy hippies wore bell-bottom pants and T-shirts that said things like, "Killing for peace is like fucking for chastity." I had a great set of mutton chop sideburns. Creedence Clearwater Revival was singing Green River, Barefoot Girls, Dancing in the Moonlight. And Kenny Rogers was still with the First Edition. Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were dead, but Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Bob the Bear Height, Jimi Hendrix, Cass Elliot, John Lennon, and Elvis Presley were still alive and making music. I was staying just off campus in Ed Price's room, $7 a week, one change of sheets included. Men had landed on the moon, and I had landed on the Dean's List. Miracles and wonders abounded. One day in late June of that summer, a bunch of us library guys had lunch on the grass behind the university bookstore. Sitting between Paolo Silva and Eddie Marsh was a trim girl with a raucous laugh, red-tinted hair, and the prettiest legs I had ever seen, well displayed beneath a short yellow skirt. She was carrying a copy of Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. I hadn't run across her in the library, and I didn't believe a college student could utter such a wonderful, unafraid laugh. Also, heavy reading or no heavy reading, she swore like a mill worker instead of a co-ed. Having been a mill worker, I was qualified to judge. Her name was Tabitha Spruce. We got married a year and a half later. We're still married, and she has never let me forget that the first time I met her, I thought she was Eddie Marsh's townie girlfriend. Maybe a book-reading waitress from the local pizza joint on her afternoon off. It's worked. Our marriage has outlasted all of the world's leaders except for Castro. And if we keep talking, arguing, making love, and dancing to the Ramones, gabba gabba hey, it'll probably keep working. We came from different religions, but as a feminist, Tabby has never been crazy about the Catholics, where the men make the rules, including the God-given directive to always go in bareback, and the women wash the underwear. And while I believe in God, I have no use for organized religion. We came from similar working-class backgrounds. We both ate meat. We were both political Democrats with typical Yankee suspicions of life outside of New England. We were sexually compatible and monogamous by nature. Yet, what ties us most strongly are the words, the language, and the work of our lives. We met when we were working in a library, and I fell in love with her during a poetry workshop in the fall of 1969, when I was a senior and Tabby was a junior. I fell in love with her partly because I understood what she was doing with her work. I fell because she understood what she was doing with it. I also fell in love because she was wearing a sexy black dress and silk stockings, the kind that hook with garters. I don't want to speak too disparagingly of my generation. Actually, I do. We had a chance to change the world and opted for the home shopping network instead. But there was a view among the student writers I knew at that time that good writing came spontaneously, in an uprush of feeling that had to be caught at once. When you were building that all-important stairway to heaven, you couldn't just stand around with your hammer in your hand. Ars Poetica in 1969 was perhaps best expressed by a Donovan Leitch song that went, "First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is." Would-be poets were living in a dewy, Tolkien-tinged world, catching poems out of the ether. It was pretty much unanimous. Serious art came from out there. Writers were blessed stenographers taking divine dictation. I don't want to embarrass any of my old mates from that period, so here is a fictionalized version of what I'm talking about, created from bits of many actual poems. I close my eyes. In the dark, I see Rodin, Rambo. In the dark, I swallow the cloth of loneliness. Crow, I am here. Raven, I am here. If you were to ask the poet what this poem meant, you'd likely get a look of contempt. A slightly uncomfortable silence was apt to emanate from the rest. Certainly, the fact that the poet would likely have been unable to tell you anything about the mechanics of creation would not have been considered important. If pressed, he or she might have said that there were no mechanics, only that seminal spurt of feeling. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. And if the resulting poem is sloppy, based on the assumption that such general words as loneliness mean the same thing to all of us, hey man, so what? Let go of that outdated bullshit and just dig the heaviness. I didn't cop much to this attitude, although I didn't dare say so out loud, at least not in so many words, and was overjoyed to find that the pretty girl in the black dress and the silk stockings didn't cop to much of it either. She didn't come right out and say so, but she didn't need to. Her work spoke for her. The workshop group met once or twice a week in the living room of instructor Jim Bishop's house, perhaps a dozen undergrads and three or four faculty members working in a marvelous atmosphere of equality. Poems were typed up and mimeographed in the English department office on the day of each workshop. Poets read while the rest of us followed along on our copies. Here is one of Tabby's poems from that fall. A Gradual Canticle for Augustine. The thinnest bear is awakened in the winter by the sleep laughter of locusts, by the dream blustering of bees, by the honeyed scent of desert sands that the wind carries in her womb into the distant hills, into the houses of cedar. The bear has heard a sure promise. Certain words are edible. They nourish more than snow heaped upon silver plates or ice overflowing golden bowls. Chips of ice from the mouth of a lover are not always better, nor a desert dreaming always a mirage. The rising bear sings a gradual canticle woven of sand that conquers cities by a slow cycle. His praise seduces a passing wind, traveling to the sea, wherein a fish, caught in a careful net, hears a bear's song in the cool-scented snow. There was silence when Tabby finished reading. No one knew exactly how to react. Cables seemed to run through the poem, tightening the lines until they almost hummed. I found the combination of crafty diction and delirious imagery exciting and illuminating. Her poem also made me feel that I wasn't alone in my belief that good writing can be simultaneously intoxicating and idea-driven. If stone-sober people can fuck like they're out of their minds, can actually be out of their minds while caught in that throw, why shouldn't writers be able to go bonkers and still stay sane? There was also a work ethic in the poem that I liked, something that suggested writing poems, or stories, or essays, had as much in common with sweeping the floor as with mythy moments of revelation. There's a place in A Raisin in the Sun where a character cries out, "I want to fly! I want to touch the sun!" To which his wife replies, "First, eat your eggs." In the discussion that followed Tab's reading, it became clear to me that she understood her own poem. She knew exactly what she had meant to say and had said most of it. St. Augustine, A.D. 354 to 430, she knew both as a Catholic and as a history major. Augustine's mother, a saint herself, was a Christian, his father a pagan. Before his conversion, Augustine pursued both money and women. Following it, he continued to struggle with his sexual impulses and is known for the libertine's prayer, which goes, "O Lord, make me chaste," but not yet. In his writing, he focused on man's struggle to give up his belief in self in favor of belief in God, and he sometimes likened himself to a bear. Tabby has a way of tilting her chin down when she smiles. It makes her look both wise and severely cute. She did that then, I remember, and said, "Besides, I like bears." The canticle is gradual, perhaps because the bear's awakening is gradual. The bear is powerful and sensual, although thin because he is out of his time. In a way, Tabby said when called upon to explicate, the bear can be seen as a symbol of mankind's troubling and wonderful habit of dreaming the right dreams at the wrong time. Such dreams are difficult because they are inappropriate, but also wonderful in their promise. The poem also suggests that dreams are powerful. The bear's is strong enough to seduce the wind into bringing his song to a fish caught in a net. I won't try to argue that A Gradual Canticle is a great poem, although I think it's a pretty good one. The point is that it was a reasonable poem in a hysterical time, one sprung from a writing ethic that resonated all through my heart and soul. Tabby was in one of Jim Bishop's rocking chairs that night. I was sitting on the floor beside her. I put my hand on her calf as she spoke, cupping the curve of warm flesh through her stocking. She smiled at me. I smiled back. Sometimes these things are not accidents. I'm almost sure of it. We had two kids by the time we'd been married 3 years. They were neither planned nor unplanned. They came when they came, and we were glad to have them. Naomi was prone to ear infections. Joe was healthy enough but never seemed to sleep. When Tabby went into labor with him, I was at a drive-in movie in Brewer with a friend. It was a Memorial Day triple feature, 3 horror films. We were on the 3rd movie, The Corpse Grinders, and the 2nd 6-pack when the guy in the office broke in with an announcement. There were still pole speakers in those days. When you parked your car, you lifted one off and hung it over your window. The manager's announcement thus rang across the entire parking lot. Steve King, please go home. Your wife is in labor. Steve King, please go home. Your wife is going to have the baby. As I drove our old Plymouth toward the exit, a couple of 100 horns blared a satiric salute. Many people flicked their headlights on and off, bathing me in a stuttery glow. My friend Jimmy Smith laughed so hard he slid into the footwell on the passenger side of the front seat. There he remained for most of the trip back to Bangor, chortling among the beer cans. When I got home, Tabby was calm and packed. She gave birth to Joe less than 3 hours later. He entered the world easily. For the next 5 years or so, nothing else about Joe was easy. But he was a treat. Both of them were, really. Even when Naomi was tearing off the wallpaper above her crib, maybe she thought she was housekeeping, and Joe was shitting in the wicker seat of the rocker we kept on the porch of our apartment on Sanford Street, they were a treat. My mother knew I wanted to be a writer. With all those rejection slips hanging from the spike on my bedroom wall, how could she not? But she encouraged me to get a teacher's credential, so you'll have something to fall back on. You may want to get married, Stephen, and a garret by the Seine is only romantic if you're a bachelor, she'd said once. It's no place to raise a family. I did as she suggested, entering the College of Education at UMO and emerging 4 years later with a teacher's certificate, sort of like a golden retriever emerging from a pond with a dead duck in its jaws. It was dead, all right. I couldn't find a teaching job and so went to work at New Franklin Laundry for wages not much higher than those I had been making at Warrumbo Mills and Weaving 4 years before. I was keeping my family in a series of garrets which overlooked not the Seine but some of Bangor's less appetizing streets, the ones where the police cruisers always seemed to show up at 2 o'clock on Saturday morning. I never saw personal laundry at New Franklin unless it was a fire order being paid for by an insurance company. Most fire orders consisted of clothes that looked okay but smelled like barbecued monkey meat. The greater part of what I loaded and pulled were motel sheets from Maine's coastal towns and table linen from Maine's coastal restaurants. The table linen was desperately nasty. When tourists go out to dinner in Maine, they usually want clams and lobster, mostly lobster. By the time the tablecloths upon which these delicacies had been served reached me, they stank to high heaven and were often boiling with maggots. The maggots would try to crawl up your arms as you loaded the washers. It was as if the little fuckers knew you were planning to cook them. I thought I'd get used to them in time, but I never did. The maggots were bad. The smell of decomposing clams and lobster meat was even worse. Why are people such slobs, I would wonder, loading feverish linens from Testa's of Bar Harbor into my machines? Why are people such fucking slobs? Hospital sheets and linens were even worse. These also crawled with maggots in the summertime, but it was blood they were feeding on instead of lobster meat and clam jelly. Clothes, sheets, and pillow slips deemed to be infected were stuffed inside what we called plague bags, which dissolved when the hot water hit them. But blood was not, in those times, considered to be especially dangerous. There were often little extras in the hospital laundry. Those loads were like nasty boxes of Cracker Jacks with weird prizes in them. I found a steel bedpan in one load and a pair of surgical shears in another. The bedpan was of no practical use, but the shears were a damned handy kitchen implement. Ernest Rocky Rockwell, the guy I worked with, found $20 in a load from Eastern Maine Medical Center and punched out at noon to start drinking, Rocky referred to quitting time as Slits O'Clock. On one occasion, I heard a strange clicking from inside one of the Washek's three pockets, which were my responsibility. I hit the emergency stop button, thinking the goddamn thing was stripping its gears or something. I opened the doors and hauled out a huge wad of dripping surgical tunics and green caps, soaking myself in the process. Below them, lying scattered across the colander-like inner sleeve of the middle pocket, was what looked like a complete set of human teeth. It crossed my mind that they would make an interesting necklace. Then I scooped them out and tossed them in the trash. My wife has put up with a lot from me over the years, but her sense of humor stretches only so far. From a financial point of view, two kids were probably too many for college grads working in a laundry in the second shift at Dunkin' Donuts. The only edge we had came courtesy of magazines like Dude, Cavalier, Adam, and Swank, what my Uncle Oren used to call the titty books. By 1972, they were showing quite a lot more than bare breasts, and fiction was on its way out, but I was lucky enough to ride the last wave. I wrote after work. When we lived on Grove Street, which was close to the New Franklin, I would sometimes write a little on my lunch hour, too. I suppose that sounds almost impossibly Abe Lincoln, but it was no big deal. I was having fun. Those stories, grim as some of them were, served as brief escapes from the boss, Mr. Brooks, and Harry the floor man. Harry had hooks instead of hands as a result of a tumble into the sheet mangler during World War II. He was dusting the beams above the machine and fell off. A comedian at heart, he would sometimes duck into the bathroom and run water from the cold tap over one hook and water from the hot tap over the other. Then he'd sneak up behind you while you were loading laundry and lay the steel hooks on the back of your neck. Rocky and I spent a fair amount of time speculating on how Harry accomplished certain bathroom cleanup activities. "Well," Rocky said one day while we were drinking our lunch in his car, "at least he doesn't need to wash his hands." There were times, especially in summer while swallowing my afternoon salt pill, when it occurred to me that I was simply repeating my mother's life. Usually this thought struck me as funny. But if I happened to be tired, or if there were extra bills to pay and no money to pay them with, it seemed awful. I'd think, this isn't the way our lives are supposed to be going. Then I'd think, half the world has the same idea. The stories I sold to the men's magazines between August of 1970, when I got my $200 check for Graveyard Shift, and the winter of 1973-1974 were just enough to create a rough sliding margin between us and the welfare office. My mother, a Republican all her life, had communicated her deep horror of going on the county to me, and Tabby had some of that same horror. My clearest memory of those days is of our coming back to the Grove Street apartment one Sunday afternoon after spending the weekend at my mother's house in Durham. This would have been right around the time the symptoms of the cancer which killed her started to show themselves. I have a picture from that day. Mom, looking both tired and amused, is sitting in a chair in her dooryard, holding Joe in her lap while Naomi stands sturdily beside her. Naomi wasn't so sturdy by Sunday afternoon, however. She had come down with an ear infection and was burning with fever. Trudging from the car to our apartment building on that summer afternoon was a low point. I was carrying Naomi and a tote bag full of baby survival equipment, bottles, lotions, diapers, sleep suits, undershirts, socks, while Tabby carried Joe, who would spit up on her. She was dragging a sack of dirty diapers behind her. We both knew Naomi needed the pink stuff, which was what we called liquid amoxicillin. The pink stuff was expensive, and we were broke. I mean, stony. I managed to get the downstairs door open without dropping my daughter and was easing her inside. She was so feverish she glowed against my chest like a banked coal. When I saw there was an envelope sticking out of our mailbox, a rare Saturday delivery. Young marrieds don't get much mail. Everyone but the gas and electric company seems to forget they are alive. I snagged it, praying it wouldn't turn out to be another bill. It wasn't. My friends at the Dugent Publishing Corporation, purveyors of Cavalier and many other fine adult publications, had sent me a check for Sometimes They Come Back, a long story I hadn't believed would sell anywhere. The check was for $500, easily the largest sum I'd ever received. Suddenly, we were able to afford not only a doctor's visit and a bottle of the pink stuff, but also a nice Sunday night meal. And I imagine that once the kids were asleep, Tabby and I got friendly. I think we had a lot of happiness in those days, but we were scared a lot, too. We weren't much more than kids ourselves, as the saying goes, and being friendly helped keep the mean Reds away. We took care of ourselves and the kids and each other as best we could. Tabby wore her pink uniform to Dunkin' Donuts and called the cops when the drunks who came in for coffee got obstreperous. I washed motel sheets and kept writing one-reel horror movies. By the time I started Carrie, I had landed a job teaching English in the nearby town of Hamden. I would be paid $6,400 a year, which seemed an unthinkable sum after earning $1.60 an hour at the laundry. If I'd done the math, being careful to add in all the time spent in after-school conferences and correcting papers at home, I might have seen it was a very thinkable sum indeed, and that our situation was worse than ever. By the late winter of 1973, we were living in a double-wide trailer in Herman, a little town west of Bangor. Much later, when asked to do the Playboy interview, I called Herman the asshole of the world. Hermanites were infuriated by that, and I hereby apologize. Herman is really no more than the armpit of the world. I was driving a Buick with transmission problems we couldn't afford to fix. Tabby was still working at Dunkin' Donuts, and we had no telephone. We simply couldn't afford the monthly charge. Tabby tried her hand at confession stories during that period, too pretty to be a virgin, stuff like that, and got personal responses of the "this isn't quite right for us, but try again" type immediately. She would have broken through if given an extra hour or two in every day, but she was stuck with the usual 24. Besides, any amusement value, the confession mag formula, it's called the three R's, rebellion, ruin, and redemption, might have had for her at the start wore off in a hurry. I wasn't having much success with my own writing either. Horror, science fiction, and crime stories in the men's magazines were being replaced by increasingly graphic tales of sex. That was part of the trouble, but not all of it. The bigger deal was that, for the first time in my life, writing was hard. The problem was the teaching. I liked my coworkers and loved the kids. Even the Beavis and Butthead types in Living with English could be interesting. But by most Friday afternoons, I felt as if I'd spent the week with jumper cables clamped to my brain. If I ever came close to despairing about my future as a writer, it was then. I could see myself 30 years on, wearing the same shabby tweed coats with patches on the elbows, pot belly rolling over my Gap khakis from too much beer. I'd have a cigarette cough from too many packs of Pall Malls, thicker glasses, more dandruff, and in my desk drawer, 6 or 7 unfinished manuscripts which I would take out and tinker with from time to time, usually when drunk. If asked what I did in my spare time, I'd tell people I was writing a book. What else does any self-respecting creative writing teacher do with his or her spare time? And of course, I'd lie to myself, telling myself there was still time. It wasn't too late. There were novelists who didn't get started until they were 50, hell, even 60. Probably plenty of them. My wife made a crucial difference during those 2 years I spent teaching at Hamden and washing sheets at New Franklin Laundry during the summer vacation. If she had suggested that the time I spent writing stories on the front porch of our rented house on Pond Street or in the laundry room of our rented trailer on Clatt Road in Herman was wasted time, I think a lot of the heart would have gone out of me. Tabby never voiced a single doubt, however. Her support was a constant, one of the few good things I could take as a given. And whenever I see a first novel dedicated to a wife or a husband, I smile and think, there's someone who knows. Writing is a lonely job. Having someone who believes in you makes a lot of difference. They don't have to make speeches. Just believing is usually enough. When he was going to college, my brother Dave worked summers as a janitor at Brunswick High, his old alma mater. For part of one summer, I worked there, too. I can't remember which year, only that it was before I met Tabby, but after I started to smoke. That would have made me 19 or 20, I suppose. I got paired with a guy named Harry, who wore green fatigues, a big keychain, and walked with a limp. He did have hands instead of hooks, however. One lunch hour, Harry told me what it had been like to face a Japanese banzai charge on the island of Tarawa, all the Japanese officers waving swords made out of Maxwell House coffee cans, all the screaming enlisted men behind them stoned out of their gourds and smelling of burned poppies. Quite a raconteur was my pal Harry. One day, he and I were supposed to scrub the rust stains off the walls in the girls' shower. I looked around the locker room with the interest of a Muslim youth who for some reason finds himself deep within the women's quarters. It was the same as the boys' locker room and yet completely different. There were no urinals, of course, and there were two extra metal boxes on the tile walls. Unmarked and the wrong size for paper towels, I asked what was in them. Pussy plugs, Harry said, for them certain days of the month. I also noticed that the showers, unlike those in the boys' locker room, had chrome U-rings with pink plastic curtains attached. You could actually shower in privacy. I mentioned this to Harry, and he shrugged. I guess young girls are a bit more shy about being undressed. This memory came back to me one day while I was working at the laundry, and I started seeing the opening scene of a story. Girls showering in a locker room where there were no U-rings, pink plastic curtains, or privacy. And this one girl starts to have her period, only she doesn't know what it is, and the other girls, grossed out, horrified, amused, start pelting her with sanitary napkins, or with tampons, which Harry had called pussy plugs. The girl begins to scream, all that blood. She thinks she's dying, that the other girls are making fun of her even when she's bleeding to death. She reacts, fights back. But how? I'd read an article in Life magazine some years before suggesting that at least some reported poltergeist activity might actually be telekinetic phenomena, telekinesis being the ability to move objects just by thinking about them. There was some evidence to suggest that young people might have such powers, the article said, especially girls in early adolescence, right around the time of their first... pow! Two unrelated ideas, adolescent cruelty and telekinesis, came together, and I had an idea. I didn't leave my post at WashX number 2, didn't go running around the laundry waving my arms and shouting Eureka, however. I'd had many other ideas as good and some that were better. Still, I thought I might have the basis for a good cavalier yarn, with the possibility of Playboy lurking in the back of my mind. Playboy paid up to $2,000 for short fiction. $2,000 would buy a new transmission for the Buick, with plenty left over for groceries. The story remained on the back burner for a while, simmering away in that place that's not quite the conscious, but not quite the subconscious either. I had started my teaching career before I sat down one night to give it a shot. I did 3 single-space pages of a first draft, then crumpled them up in disgust and threw them away. I had 4 problems with what I'd written. First and least important was the fact that the story didn't move me emotionally. Second, and slightly more important, was the fact that I didn't much like the lead character. Carrie White seemed thick and passive, a ready-made victim. The other girls were chucking tampons and sanitary napkins at her, chanting, plug it up, and I just didn't care. Third, and more important still, was not feeling at home with either the surroundings or my all-girl cast of supporting characters. I had landed on Planet Female, and one sortie into the girls' locker room at Brunswick High School years before wasn't much help in navigating there. For me, writing has always been best when it's intimate, as sexy as skin on skin. With Carrie, I felt as if I were wearing a rubber wetsuit I couldn't pull off. Fourth, and most important of all, was the realization that the story wouldn't pay off unless it was pretty long, probably even longer than sometimes they come back, which had been at the absolute outer limit of what the men's magazine market could accept in terms of word count. You had to save plenty of room for those pictures of cheerleaders who had somehow forgotten to put on their underpants. They were what guys really bought the magazines for. I couldn't see wasting 2 weeks, maybe even a month, creating a novella I didn't like and wouldn't be able to sell, so I threw it away. The next night, when I came home from school, Tabby had the pages. She'd spied them while emptying my wastebasket, had shaken the cigarette ashes off the crumpled balls of paper, smoothed them out, and sat down to read them. She wanted me to go on with it, she said. She wanted to know the rest of the story. I told her I didn't know jack shit about high school girls. She said she'd help me with that part. She had her chin tilted down and was smiling in that severely cute way of hers. You've got something here, she said. I really think you do. I never got to like Carrie White, and I never trusted Sue Snell's motives in sending her boyfriend to the prom with her. But I did have something there, like a whole career. Tabby somehow knew it, and by the time I had piled up 50 single-space pages, I knew it too. For one thing, I didn't think any of the characters who went to Carrie White's prom would ever forget it. Those few who lived through it, that was. I had written 3 other novels before Carrie. Rage, The Long Walk, and The Running Man were later published. Rage is the most troubling of them. The Long Walk may be the best of them. But none of them taught me the things I learned from Carrie White. The most important is that the writer's original perception of a character, or characters, may be as erroneous as the reader's. Running a close second was the realization that stopping a piece of work just because it's hard, either emotionally or imaginatively, is a bad idea. Sometimes you have to go on when you don't feel like it, and sometimes you're doing good work when it feels like all you're managing is to shovel shit from a sitting position. Tabby helped me, beginning with the information that the sanitary napkin dispensers in high schools were usually not coin-op. Faculty and administration didn't like the idea of girls walking around with blood all over their skirts just because they happened to come to school short a quarter, my wife said. And I also helped myself, digging back to my memories of high school. My job teaching English didn't help. I was 26 by then, and on the wrong side of the desk. Remembering what I knew about the 2 loneliest, most reviled girls in my class. How they looked, how they acted, how they were treated. Very rarely in my career have I explored more distasteful territory. I'll call one of these girls Sandra. She and her mother lived in a trailer home not too far from me with their dog, Cheddar Cheese. Sandra had a burbly, uneven voice, as if she were always speaking through a throat full of tightly packed phlegm. She wasn't fat, but her flesh had a loose, pale look, like the undersides of some mushrooms. Her hair clung to her pimply cheeks in tight little orphan Annie curls. She had no friends, except for Cheddar Cheese, I guess. One day, her mother hired me to move some furniture. Dominating the trailer's living room was a nearly life-sized crucified Jesus, eyes turned up, mouth turned down, blood dribbling from beneath the crown of thorns on his head. He was naked except for a rag twisted around his hips and loins. Above this bit of breech clout were the hollowed belly and the jutting ribs of a concentration camp inmate. It occurred to me that Sandra had grown up beneath the agonal gaze of this dying god, and doing so had undoubtedly played a part in making her what she was when I knew her, a timid and homely outcast who went scuttling through the halls of Lisbon High like a frightened mouse. "That's Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior," Sandra's mother said, following my gaze. "Have you been saved, Steve?" I hastened to tell her I was saved as saved could be, although I didn't think you could ever be good enough to have that version of Jesus intervene on your behalf. The pain had driven him out of his mind. You could see it on his face. If that guy came back, he probably wouldn't be in a saving mood. The other girl, I'll call Dodie Franklin, only the other girls called her Dodo or Doo-Doo. Her parents were interested in only one thing, and that was entering contests. They were good at them, too. They had won all sorts of odd stuff, including a year's supply of Three Diamonds brand fancy tuna and Jack Benny's Maxwell automobile. The Maxwell sat off to the left of their house in that part of Durham known as Southwest Bend, gradually sinking into the landscape. Every year or two, one of the local papers, the Portland Press Herald, the Lewiston Sun, the Lisbon Weekly Enterprise, would do a piece on all the weird shit Doty's folks had won in raffles and sweepstakes and giant prize drawings. Usually there would be a photo of the Maxwell, or Jack Benny with his violin, or both. Whatever the Franklins might have won, a supply of clothes for growing teenagers wasn't part of the haul. Doty and her brother Bill wore the same stuff every day for the first year and a half of high school. Black pants and short-sleeved checked sport shirt for him, a long black skirt, gray knee socks, and a sleeveless white blouse for her. Some of my readers may not believe I am being literal when I say every day, but those who grew up in country towns during the 50s and 60s will know that I am. In the Durham of my childhood, life wore little or any makeup. I went to school with kids who wore the same neck dirt for months, kids whose skin festered with sores and rashes, kids with the eerie, dried apple doll faces that result from untreated burns, kids who were sent to school with stones in their dinner buckets and nothing but air in their thermoses. It wasn't Arcadia. For the most part, it was dog patch with no sense of humor. Doty and Bill Franklin got on all right at Durham Elementary, but high school meant a much bigger town, and for children like Doty and Bill, Lisbon Falls meant ridicule and ruin. We watched in amusement and horror as Bill's sports shirt faded and began to unravel from the short sleeves up. He replaced a missing button with a paperclip. Tape, carefully colored black with a crayon to match his pants, appeared over a rip behind one knee. Doty's sleeveless white blouse began to grow yellow with wear, age, and accumulated sweat stains. As it grew thinner, the straps of her bra showed through more and more clearly. The other girls made fun of her, at first behind her back and then to her face. Teasing became taunting. The boys weren't a part of it. We had Bill to take care of. Yes, I helped. Not a whole lot, but I was there. Doty had it worse, I think. The girls didn't just laugh at Doty. They hated her, too. Doty was everything they were afraid of. After Christmas vacation of our sophomore year, Doty came back to school resplendent. The dowdy old black skirt had been replaced by a cranberry-colored one that stopped at her knees instead of halfway down her shins. The tatty knee socks had been replaced by nylon stockings, which looked pretty good because she had finally shaved the luxuriant mat of black hair off her legs. The ancient sleeveless blouse had given way to a soft wool sweater. She'd even had a permanent. Doty was a girl transformed, and you could see by her face that she knew it. I have no idea if she saved for those new clothes, if they were given to her for Christmas by her parents, or if she went through a hell of begging that finally bore dividends. It doesn't matter, because mere clothes changed nothing. The teasing that day was worse than ever. Her peers had no intention of letting her out of the box they'd put her in. She was punished for even trying to break free. I had several classes with her and was able to observe Doty's ruination at first hand. I saw her smile fade, saw the light in her eyes first dim and then go out. By the end of the day, she was the girl she'd been before Christmas vacation, a dough-faced and freckle-cheeked wraith, scurrying through the halls with her eyes down and her books clasped to her chest. She wore the new skirt and sweater the next day, and the next, and the next. When the school year ended, she was still wearing them, although by then the weather was much too hot for wool, and there were always beads of sweat at her temples and on her upper lip. The home permanent wasn't repeated, and the new clothes took on a matted, dispirited look. But the teasing had dropped back to its pre-Christmas levels, and the taunting stopped entirely. Someone made a break for the fence and had to be knocked down, that was all. Once the escape was foiled and the entire company of prisoners was once more accounted for, life could go back to normal. Both Sandra and Dodie were dead by the time I started writing Carrie. Sandra moved out of the trailer in Durham, out from beneath the agonal gaze of the dying savior, and into an apartment in Lisbon Falls. She must have worked somewhere close by, probably in one of the mills or shoe factories. She was epileptic and died during a seizure. She lived alone, so there was no one to help her when she went down with her head bent the wrong way. Dodie married a TV weatherman who gained something of a reputation in New England for his drawling down east delivery. Following the birth of a child, I think it was their second, Dodie went into the cellar and put a .22 bullet in her abdomen. It was a lucky shot, or unlucky, depending on your point of view, I guess, hitting the portal vein and killing her. In town, they said it was postpartum depression. How sad. Myself, I suspected high school hangover might have had something to do with it. I never liked Carrie, that female version of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, but through Sandra and Dodie, I came at last to understand her a little. I pitied her, and I pitied her classmates as well, because I had been one of them once upon a time. The manuscript of Carrie went off to Doubleday, where I had made a friend named William Thompson. I pretty much forgot about it and moved on with my life, which at that time consisted of teaching school, raising kids, loving my wife, getting drunk on Friday afternoons, and writing stories. My free period that semester was 5, right after lunch. I usually spent it in the teacher's room, grading papers and wishing I could stretch out on the couch and take a nap. In the early afternoon, I have all the energy of a boa constrictor that's just swallowed a goat. The intercom came on, and Colleen Seitz in the office asked if I was there. I said I was, and she asked me to come up to the office. I had a phone call. My wife. The walk from the teacher's room in the lower wing to the main office seemed long, even with classes in session and the halls mostly empty. I hurried, not quite running, my heart beating hard. Tabby would have had to dress the kids in their boots and jackets to use the neighbor's phone, and I could think of only two reasons she might have done so. Either Joe or Naomi had fallen off the stoop and broken a leg, or I had sold Carrie. My wife, sounding out of breath but deliriously happy, read me a telegram. Bill Thompson, who would later go on to discover a Mississippi scribbler named John Grisham, had sent it after trying to call and discovering the Kings no longer had a phone. "Congratulations," it read. "Carrie, officially a Doubleday book. Is $2,500 advance okay? The future lies ahead. Love, Bill." $2,500 was a very small advance, even for the early 70s, but I didn't know that and had no literary agent to know it for me. Before it occurred to me that I might actually need an agent, I had generated well over $3 million worth of income, a good deal of it for the publisher. The standard Doubleday contract in those days was better than indentured servitude, but not much. And my little high school horror novel marched toward publication with excruciating slowness. Although it was accepted in late March or early April of 1973, publication wasn't slated until the spring of 1974. This wasn't unusual. In those days, Doubleday was an enormous fiction mill churning out mysteries, romances, science fiction yarns, and Double D Westerns at a rate of 50 or more a month. All of this in addition to a robust front list, including books by heavy hitters like Leon Uris and Alan Drury. I was only one small fish in a very busy river. Tabby asked if I could quit teaching. I told her no, not based on a $2,500 advance and only nebulous possibilities beyond that. If I'd been on my own, maybe, hell, probably, but with a wife and two kids, not happening. I remember the two of us lying in bed that night, eating toast and talking until the small hours of the morning. Tabby asked me how much we'd make if Doubleday was able to sell paperback reprint rights to Carrie, and I said I didn't know. I'd read that Mario Puzo had just scored a huge advance for paperback rights to The Godfather, $400,000, according to the newspaper, but I didn't believe Carrie would fetch anything near that, assuming it sold to paperback at all. Tabby asked, rather timidly for my normally outspoken wife, if I thought the book would find a paperback publisher. I told her I thought the chances were pretty good, maybe 7 or 8 in 10. She asked how much it might bring. I said my best guess would be somewhere between $10,000 and $60,000. $60,000? She sounded almost shocked. Is that much even possible? I said it was, not likely perhaps, but possible. I also reminded her that my contract specified a 50-50 paperback split, which meant that if Ballantyne or Dell did pay 60 grand, we'd only get 30. Tabby didn't dignify this with a reply. She didn't have to. $30,000 was what I could expect to make in 4 years of teaching, even with annual salary increases thrown in. It was a lot of money, probably just pie in the sky, but it was a night for dreaming. Carrie inched along toward publication. We spent the advance on a new car, a standard shift that Tabby hated and reviled in her most colorful mill worker's language, and I signed a teaching contract for the 1973-1974 academic year. I was writing a new novel, a peculiar combination of Peyton Place and Dracula, which I called Second Coming. We had moved to a ground-floor apartment back in Bangor, a real pit, but we were in town again. We had a car covered by an actual warranty, and we had a telephone. To tell you the truth, Carrie had fallen off my radar screen almost completely. The kids were a handful, both the ones at school and the ones at home, and I had begun to worry about my mother. She was 61, still working at Pineland Training Center, and as funny as ever, but Dave said she didn't feel very well a lot of the time. Her bedside table was covered with prescription painkillers, and he was afraid there might be something seriously wrong with her. She's always smoked like a chimney, you know, Dave said. He was a great one to talk, since he smoked like a chimney himself. So did I, and how my wife hated the expense and constant ashy dirt of it. But I knew what he meant, and although I didn't live as close to her as Dave and didn't see her as often, the last time I had seen her, I could tell she had lost weight. What can we do? I asked. Behind the question was all we knew of our mother, who kept herself to herself, as she liked to say. The result of that philosophy was a vast gray space where other families have histories. Dave and I knew almost nothing about our father or his family, and little enough about our own mother's past, which included an incredible, to me at least, 8 dead brothers and sisters, and her own failed ambition to become a concert pianist. She did play the organ on some of the NBC radio soaps and Sunday church shows during the war, she claimed. We can't do anything, Dave replied, until she asks. One Sunday, not long after that call, I got another one from Bill Thompson at Doubleday. I was alone in the apartment. Tabby had packed the kids off to her mother's for a visit, and I was working on the new book, which I thought of as Vampires in Our Town. Are you sitting down? Bill asked. No, I said. Our phone hung on the kitchen wall, and I was standing in the doorway between the kitchen and the living room. Do I need to? You might, he said. The paperback rights to Carrie went to Signet Books for $400,000. When I was a little kid, Daddy Guy had once said to my mother, "Why don't you shut that kid up, Ruth? When Stephen opens his mouth, all his guts fall out." It was true then, has been true all my life. But on that Mother's Day in May of 1973, I was completely speechless. I stood there in the doorway, casting the same shadow as always, but I couldn't talk. Bill asked if I was still there, kind of laughing as he said it. He knew I was. I hadn't heard him right. Couldn't have. The idea allowed me to find my voice again, at least. Did you say it went for $40,000? $400,000, he said. Under the rules of the road, meaning the contract I'd signed, $200K of it's yours. Congratulations, Steve. I was still standing in the doorway, looking across the living room toward our bedroom and the crib where Joe slept. Our place on Sanford Street rented for $90 a month, and this man I'd only met once, face to face, was telling me I'd just won the lottery. The strength ran out of my legs. I didn't fall exactly, but I kind of whooshed down to a sitting position there in the doorway. "Are you sure?" I asked Bill. He said he was. I asked him to say the number again, very slowly and very clearly, so I could be sure I hadn't misunderstood. He said the number was a 4, followed by 5 zeros. After that, a decimal point and 2 more zeros, he added. We talked for another half an hour, but I don't remember a single word of what we said. When the conversation was over, I tried to call Tabby at her mother's. Her youngest sister, Marcella, said Tab had already left. I walked back and forth through the apartment in my stocking feet, exploding with good news and without an ear to hear it. I was shaking all over. At last, I pulled on my shoes and walked downtown. The only store that was open on Bangor's Main Street was the Laverdier Drug. I suddenly felt that I had to buy Tabby a Mother's Day present, something wild and extravagant. I tried, but here's one of life's true facts. There's nothing really wild or extravagant for sale at Laverdier's. I did the best I could. I got her a hairdryer. When I got back home, she was in the kitchen unpacking the baby bags and singing along with the radio. I gave her the hairdryer. She looked at it as if she'd never seen one before. "What's this for?" she asked. I took her by the shoulders. I told her about the paperback sale. She didn't appear to understand. I told her again. Tabby looked over my shoulder at our shitty little four-room apartment, just as I had, and began to cry. I got drunk for the first time in 1966. This was on the senior class trip to Washington. We went on a bus, about 40 kids and 3 chaperones. One of them was old Q-Ball, as a matter of fact, and spent the first night in New York, where the drinking age was then 18. Thanks to my bad ears and shitty tonsils, I was almost 19, room to spare. A bunch of us more adventurous boys found a package store around the corner from the hotel. I cast an eye over the shelves, aware that my spending money was far from a fortune. There was too much, too many bottles, too many brands, too many prices over $10. Finally, I gave up and asked the guy behind the counter, the same bald, bored-looking, gray-coated guy who has, I'm convinced, sold alcohol virgins their first bottle since the dawn of commerce, what was cheap. Without a word, he put a pint of old log cabin whiskey down on the Winston mat beside the cash register. The sticker on the label said $1.95. The price was right. I have a memory of being led onto the elevator later that night, or maybe it was early the next morning, by Peter Higgins, old Q-Ball's son, Butch Michaud, Lenny Partridge, and John Chismar. This memory is more like a scene from a TV show than a real memory. I seem to be outside of myself, watching the whole thing. There's just enough of me left inside to know that I am globally, perhaps even galactically, fucked up. The camera watches as we go up to the girls' floor. The camera watches as I am propelled up and down the hall, a kind of rolling exhibit. An amusing one, it seems. The girls are in nighties, robes, curlers, cold cream. They are all laughing at me, but their laughter seems good-natured enough. The sound is muted, as if I am hearing them through cotton. I am trying to tell Carol Lemke that I love the way she wears her hair, and that she has the most beautiful blue eyes in the world. What comes out is something like, "Aga wuggin blue eyes, wuggin ruggin whole world." Carol laughs and nods as if she understands completely. I am very happy. The world is seeing an asshole, no doubt, but he is a happy asshole, and everyone loves him. I spend several minutes trying to tell Gloria Moore that I've discovered the secret life of Dean Martin. At some point after that, I am in my bed. The bed holds still, but the room starts to spin around it faster and faster. It occurs to me that it's spinning like the turntable of my Webcor phonograph, on which I used to play Fats Domino and now play Dylan in the Dave Clark Five. The room is the turntable. I am the spindle, and pretty soon the spindle is going to start tossing its platters. I go away for a little bit. When I wake up, I'm on my knees in the bathroom of the double room I'm sharing with my friend, Louis Purington. I have no idea how I got in there, but it's good that I did, because the toilet is full of bright yellow puke. Looks like niblets, I think, and that's all it takes to get me going again. Nothing comes up but whiskey-flavored strings of spit, but my head feels like it's going to explode. I can't walk. I crawl back to bed with my sweaty hair hanging in my eyes. I'll feel better tomorrow, I think, and then I go away again. In the morning, my stomach is settled a little, but my diaphragm is sore from vomiting, and my head is throbbing like a mouthful of infected teeth. My eyes have turned into magnifying glasses. The hideously bright morning light coming in through the hotel windows is being concentrated by them and will soon set my brains on fire. Participating in that day's scheduled activities, a walk to Times Square, a boat ride to the Statue of Liberty, a climb to the top of the Empire State Building, is out of the question. Walking? Irk. Boats? Double irk. Elevators? Irk to the fourth power. Christ, I can hardly move. I make some sort of feeble excuse and spend most of the day in bed. By late afternoon, I'm feeling a little better. I dress, creep down the hall to the elevator, and descend to the first floor. Eating is still impossible, but I believe I'm ready for a ginger ale, a cigarette, and a magazine. And who should I see in the lobby, sitting in a chair and reading a newspaper, but Mr. Earl Higgins, alias Old Cue Ball? I pass him as silently as I can, but it's no good. When I come back from the gift shop, he's sitting with his newspaper in his lap, looking at me. I feel my stomach drop. Here is more trouble with the principal, probably even worse than the trouble I got into over the village vomit. He calls me over, and I discover something interesting. Mr. Higgins is actually an okay guy. He bounced me pretty hard over my joke newspaper, but perhaps Miss Margotin had insisted on that. And I'd just been 16, after all. On the day of my first hangover, I'm going on 19. I've been accepted at the state university, and I have a mill job waiting for me when the class trip is over. I understand you were too sick to tour New York with the rest of the boys and girls, Old Cue Ball says. He eyes me up and down. I say, that's right, I'd been sick. A shame for you to miss the fun, Old Cue Ball says. Feeling better now? Yes, I was feeling better. Probably stomach flu, one of those 24-hour bugs. I hope you won't get that bug again, he says. At least, not on this trip. He looks at me for a moment longer, his eyes asking if we understand each other. I'm sure I won't, I say, meaning it. I know what drunk is like now, a vague sense of roaring goodwill, a clearer sense that most of your consciousness is out of your body, hovering like a camera in a science fiction movie and filming everything. And then the sickness, the puking, the aching head. No, I won't get that bug again, I tell myself. Not on this trip, not ever. Once is enough, just to find out what it's like. Only an idiot would make a second experiment, and only a lunatic, a masochistic lunatic, would make booze a regular part of his life. The next day we go on to Washington, making one stop in Amish country on the way. There's a liquor store near where the bus parks. I go in and look around. Although the drinking age in Pennsylvania is 21, I must look easily that in my one good suit and Faza's old black overcoat. In fact, I probably look like a freshly released young convict, tall and hungry and very likely not bolted together right. The clerk sells me a fifth of four roses without asking to see any ID, and by the time we stop for the night, I'm drunk again. 10 years or so later, I'm in an Irish saloon with Bill Thompson. We have lots to celebrate, not the least of which is the completion of my third book, The Shining. That's the one which just happens to be about an alcoholic writer and ex-school teacher. It's July, the night of the All-Star baseball game. Our plan is to eat a good old-fashioned meal from the dishes set out on the steam table, then get shit-faced. We begin with a couple at the bar, and I start reading all the signs. "Have a Manhattan in Manhattan," says one. "Tuesdays are twofers," says another. "Work is the curse of the drinking class," says a third. And there, right in front of me, is one which reads, "Early bird special, screwdrivers a buck, Monday to Friday, 8 to 10 a.m. I motion to the bartender. He comes over. He's bald. He's wearing a gray jacket. He could be the guy who sold me my first pint back in 1966. Probably he is. I point to the sign and ask, "Who comes in at 8:15 in the morning and orders a screwdriver?" I'm smiling, but he doesn't smile back. "College boys," he replies. "Just like you." In 1971 or 72, Mom's sister, Carolyn Weimer, died of breast cancer. My mother and my Aunt Ethlyn, Carolyn's twin, flew out to Aunt Cal's funeral in Minnesota. It was the first time my mother had flown in 20 years. On the plane trip back, she began to bleed profusely from what she would have called her privates. Although long past her change of life by that point, she told herself it was simply one final menstrual period. Locked in the tiny bathroom of a bouncing TWA jet, she stanched the bleeding with tampons. "Plug it up, plug it up," as Sue Snell and her friends might have cried. Then returned to her seat. She said nothing to Ethlyn and nothing to David and me. She didn't go to see Joe Mendes in Lisbon Falls, her physician since time out of mind. Instead of any of those things, she did what she always did in times of trouble. Kept herself to herself. For a while, things seemed to be all right. She enjoyed her job. She enjoyed her friends. She enjoyed her four grandchildren, two from Dave's family and two from mine. Then things stopped being all right. In August of 1973, during a checkup following an operation to strip some of her outrageously varicose veins, my mother was diagnosed with uterine cancer. I think Nellie Ruth Pillsbury King, who once dumped a bowl of Jell-O on the floor and then danced in it while her two boys lay collapsed in the corner, screaming with laughter, actually died of embarrassment. The end came in February of 1974. By then, a little of the money from Carrie had begun to flow, and I was able to help with some of the medical expenses. There was that much to be glad about. And I was there for the last of it, staying in the back bedroom of Dave and Linda's place. I'd been drunk the night before, but was only moderately hungover, which was good. One wouldn't want to be too hungover at the deathbed of one's mother. Dave woke me up at 6:15 in the morning, calling softly through the door that he thought she was going. When I got into the master bedroom, he was sitting beside her on the bed and holding a cool for her to smoke. This she did between harsh gasps for breath. She was only semi-conscious, her eyes going from Dave to me and then back to Dave again. I sat next to Dave, took the cigarette, and held it to her mouth. Her lips stretched out to clamp on the filter. Beside her bed, reflected over and over again in a cluster of glasses, was an early bound galley of Carrie. Aunt Ethlyn had read it to her aloud a month or so before she died. Mom's eyes went from Dave to me, Dave to me, Dave to me. She had gone from 160 pounds to about 90. Her skin was yellow and so tightly stretched that she looked like one of those mummies they parade through the streets of Mexico on the Day of the Dead. We took turns holding the cigarette for her, and when it was down to the filter, I put it out. "My boys," she said, then lapsed into what might have been sleep or unconsciousness. My head ached. I took a couple of aspirin from one of the many bottles of medicine on her table. Dave held one of her hands, and I held the other. Under the sheet was not the body of our mother, but that of a starved and deformed child. Dave and I smoked and talked a little. I don't remember what we said. It had rained the night before, then the temperature had dropped, and the morning streets were filled with ice. We could hear the pause after each rasping breath she drew, growing longer and longer. Finally, there were no more breaths, and it was all pause. My mother was buried out of the Congregational Church at Southwest Bend. The church she'd attended in Methodist Corners, where my brother and I grew up, was closed because of the cold. I gave the eulogy. I think I did a pretty good job, considering how drunk I was. Alcoholics build defenses like the Dutch build dikes. I spent the first 12 years or so of my married life assuring myself that I just liked to drink. I also employed the world-famous Hemingway defense. Although never clearly articulated, it would not be manly to do so. The Hemingway defense goes something like this. As a writer, I am a very sensitive fellow, but I am also a man, and real men don't give in to their sensitivities. Only sissy men do that. Therefore, I drink. How else can I face the existential horror of it all and continue to work? Besides, come on, I can handle it. A real man always can. Then, in the early 80s, Maine's legislature enacted a returnable bottle and can law. Instead of going into the trash, my 16-ounce cans of Miller Lite started going into a plastic container in the garage. One Thursday night, I went out there to toss in a few dead soldiers and saw that this container, which had been empty on Monday night, was now almost full. And since I was the only one in the house who drank Miller Lite, holy shit, I'm an alcoholic, I thought. And there was no dissenting opinion from inside my head. I was, after all, the guy who had written The Shining without even realizing, at least until that night, that I was writing about myself. My reaction to this idea wasn't denial or disagreement. It was what I'd call frightened determination. You have to be careful then, I clearly remember thinking. Because if I fucked up, rolled my car over on a back road some night, or blew an interview on live TV, someone would tell me I ought to get control of my drinking, and telling an alcoholic to control his drinking is like telling a guy suffering the world's most cataclysmic case of diarrhea to control his shitting. A friend of mine who's been through this tells an amusing story about his first tentative effort to get a grip on his increasingly slippery life. He went to a counselor and said his wife was worried that he was drinking too much. "How much do you drink?" the counselor asked. My friend looked at the counselor with disbelief. "All of it," he said, as if that should have been self-evident. I know how he felt. It's been almost 12 years since I took a drink, and I'm still struck by disbelief when I see someone in a restaurant with a half-finished glass of wine near at hand. I want to get up, go over, and yell, "Finish that! Why don't you finish that?" into his or her face. I found the idea of social drinking ludicrous. If you didn't want to get drunk, why not just have a Coke? My nights during the last 5 years of my drinking always ended with the same ritual. I'd pour any beers left in the refrigerator down the sink. If I didn't, they'd talk to me as I lay in bed until I got up and had another. And another. And one more. By 1985, I had added drug addiction to my alcohol problem, yet I continued to function, as a good many substance abusers do, on a marginally competent level. I was terrified not to. By then, I had no idea of how to live any other life. I hid the drugs I was taking as well as I could, both out of terror. What would happen to me without dope? I had forgotten the trick of being straight. And out of shame. I was wiping my ass with poison ivy again, this time on a daily basis, but I couldn't ask for help. That's not the way you did things in my family. In my family, what you did was smoke your cigarettes and dance in the jello and keep yourself to yourself. Yet the part of me that writes the stories, the deep part that knew I was an alcoholic as early as 1975 when I wrote The Shining, wouldn't accept that. Silence isn't what that part is about. It began to scream for help in the only way it knew how, through my fiction and through my monsters. In late 1985 and early 1986, I wrote Misery, the title quite aptly described my state of mind, in which a writer is held prisoner and tortured by a psychotic nurse. In the spring and summer of 1986, I wrote The Tommyknockers, often working until midnight, with my heart running at 130 beats a minute and cotton swabs stuck up my nose to stem the coke-induced bleeding. Tommyknockers is a 40s-style science fiction tale in which the writer heroine discovers an alien spacecraft buried in the ground. The crew is still on board, not dead but only hibernating. These alien creatures got into your head and just started, well, Tommyknocking around in there. What you got was energy and a kind of superficial intelligence. The writer, Bobby Anderson, creates a telepathic typewriter and an atomic hot water heater, among other things. What you gave up in exchange was your soul. It was the best metaphor for drugs and alcohol my tired, overstressed mind could come up with. Not long after that, my wife, finally convinced that I wasn't going to pull out of this ugly downward spiral on my own, stepped in. It couldn't have been easy. By then I was no longer within shouting distance of my right mind, but she did it. She organized an intervention group formed of family and friends, and I was treated to a kind of this is your life in hell. Tabby began by dumping a trash bag full of stuff from my office out on the rug. Beer cans, cigarette butts, cocaine in gram bottles and cocaine in plastic baggies, coke spoons caked with snot and blood, Valium, Xanax, bottles of Robitussin cough syrup and NyQuil cold medicine, even bottles of mouthwash. A year or so before, observing the rapidity with which huge bottles of Listerine were disappearing from the bathroom, Tabby asked me if I drank the stuff. I responded with self-righteous hauteur that I most certainly did not. Nor did I. I drank the scope instead. It was tastier, had that hint of mint. The point of this intervention, which was certainly as unpleasant for my wife and kids and friends as it was for me, was that I was dying in front of them. Tabby said I had my choice. I could get help at a rehab, or I could get the hell out of the house. She said that she and the kids loved me, and for that very reason none of them wanted to witness my suicide. I bargained because that's what addicts do. I was charming because that's what addicts are. In the end, I got 2 weeks to think about it. In retrospect, this seems to summarize all the insanity of that time. Guy is standing on top of a burning building. Helicopter arrives, hovers, drops a rope ladder. Climb up, the man leaning out of the helicopter door shouts. Guy on top of the burning building responds, give me 2 weeks to think about it. I did think, though, as well as I could in my addled state. And what finally decided me was Annie Wilkes, the psycho nurse in Misery. Annie was coke. Annie was booze, and I decided I was tired of being Annie's pet writer. I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to work anymore if I quit drinking and drugging, but I decided, again, so far as I was able to decide anything in my distraught and depressed state of mind, that I would trade writing for staying married and watching the kids grow up, if it came to that. It didn't, of course. The idea that creative endeavor and mind-altering substances are entwined is one of the great pop intellectual myths of our time. The four 20th-century writers whose work is most responsible for it are probably Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Sherwood Anderson, and the poet Dylan Thomas. They are the writers who largely formed our vision of an existential English-speaking wasteland where people have been cut off from one another and live in an atmosphere of emotional strangulation and despair. These concepts are very familiar to most alcoholics. The common reaction to them is amusement. Substance-abusing writers are just substance abusers, common garden-variety drunks and druggies, in other words. Any claims that drugs and alcohol are necessary to dull a finer sensibility are just the usual self-serving bullshit. I've heard alcoholic snowplow drivers make the same claim, that they drink to still the demons. It doesn't matter if you're James Jones, John Cheever, or a stew bum snoozing in Penn Station. For an addict, the right to the drink or drug of choice must be preserved at all costs. Hemingway and Fitzgerald didn't drink because they were creative, alienated, or morally weak. They drank because it's what alkies are wired up to do. Creative people probably do run a greater risk of alcoholism and addiction than those in some other jobs, but so what? We all look pretty much the same when we're puking in the gutter. At the end of my adventures, I was drinking a case of 16-ounce tall boys a night, and there's one novel, Cujo, that I barely remember writing at all. I don't say that with pride or shame, only with a vague sense of sorrow and loss. I like that book. I wish I could remember enjoying the good parts as I put them down on the page. At the worst of it, I no longer wanted to drink and no longer wanted to be sober either. I felt evicted from life. At the start of the road back, I just tried to believe the people who said that things would get better if I gave them time to do so. And I never stopped writing. Some of the stuff that came out was tentative and flat, but at least it was there. I buried those unhappy, lackluster pages in the bottom drawer of my desk and got on to the next project. Little by little, I found the beat again, and after that, I found the joy again. I came back to my family with gratitude and back to my work with relief. I came back to it the way folks come back to a summer cottage after a long winter, checking first to make sure nothing has been stolen or broken during the cold season. Nothing had been. It was still all there, still all whole. Once the pipes were thawed out and the electricity was turned back on, everything worked fine. The last thing I want to tell you in this part is about my desk. For years, I dreamed of having the sort of massive oak slab that would dominate a room. No more child's desk in a trailer laundry closet, no more cramped knee hole in a rented house. In 1981, I got the one I wanted and placed it in the middle of a spacious skylighted study. It's a converted stable loft at the rear of the house. For 6 years, I sat behind that desk either drunk or wrecked out of my mind, like a ship's captain in charge of a voyage to nowhere. A year or so after I sobered up, I got rid of that monstrosity and put in a living room suite where it had been, picking out the pieces and a nice Turkish rug with my wife's help. In the early 90s, before they moved on to their own lives, my kids sometimes came up in the evening to watch a basketball game or a movie and eat pizza. They usually left a box full of crusts behind when they moved on, but I didn't care. They came, they seemed to enjoy being with me, and I know I enjoyed being with them. I got another desk. It's handmade, beautiful, and half the size of the T-Rex desk. I put it at the far west end of the office, in a corner, under the eave. That eave is very like the one I slept under in Durham, but there are no rats in the walls and no senile grandmother downstairs yelling for someone to feed Dick, the horse. I'm sitting under it now, a 53-year-old man with bad eyes, a gimp leg, and no hangover. I'm doing what I know how to do, and as well as I know how to do it. I came through all the stuff I told you about, and plenty more I didn't, and now I'm going to tell you as much as I can about the job. As promised, it won't take long. It starts with this. Put your desk in the corner, and every time you sit down there to write, remind yourself why it isn't in the middle of the room. Life isn't a support system for art. It's the other way around.